Campus FM presents A Book, A Thousand Stories. A review of the book, The Hare with Amber Eyes, by Edmond de Waal. Production and presentation, Patricia Salomone. Musical advice by Gerald Fennec, and technical support by Samuel Attard and Carmelo Grech. We closed last week's episode of A Book, A Thousand Stories with Iggy's decision to take up work in Japan and take the Netsuke collection with him. Iggy, Ignaz Leon Efrusi, would have inherited his father's banking business in Vienna had he not chosen to escape and to carve out for himself a position in the world of fashion in Paris and then in the States. But World War II intervened to change his destiny, that of his family, of 6 million Jews, and, in truth, to change the life of all and sundry after the second catastrophe of the 20th century. Iggy said that fashion had given up on him. His nephew Edmund writes, the thread from Vienna to Paris to New York had been broken by his battle experiences in 1944 in France.
Having you to talk with,
and it's still a thrill just to have my arms around you.
Still the thrill.
On a visit to his sister in England in 1947, Iggy again sets eyes on the peculiar collection of Japanese Netsuke and decides that he will take up a post he is offered in Japan and he will take the collection back to their country of origin.
Seems like old times being here with you.
Iggy arrived in Haneda Airport in the winter of 1947-1948, 2 years after Emperor Hirohito had broadcast his declaration of defeat, warning his people that they would be subjected to great hardship. The announcement made by Emperor Hirohito to his people in informing them of the surrender is a heartbreaking speech. I have met here in Malta a Japanese lady, Akiko Miyahara, who will be reading this speech, of course in English, so that we may all understand. It is dramatic and painful.
Emperor Hirohito's announcement, August 14, 1945. To our good and loyal subject. After pondering deeply the general friend of the world and the actual condition obtained in our empire today, we have decided to effect a settlement of the present situation by resorting an extraordinary measure. We have ordered our government to communicate to the governments of the United States, Great Britain, China, and the Soviet Union that our empire accepts the provision of their joint declaration. To strive for the common prosperity and the happiness of all nations, as well as the security and well-being of our subject, is a solemn obligation which has been handed down by our imperial ancestor and which lies close to our heart. Indeed, we declare the war on America and Britain out of our sincere desire to ensure Japan's self-preservation and stabilization of East Asia, it being far from our thought to infringe upon the sovereignty of other nations. But now, the war has lasted for nearly 4 years, despite the best has been done by everyone. The gallant fighting of the military and naval forces, the diligence and assiduity of our servant of the state, and the devoted serve of our 100 million people. The war situation has developed not necessarily to Japan's advantage, while general friends of the world have all turned against her interest. Moreover, the enemy has begun to employ a new and most cruel bomb, the power of which to damage is indeed incredible, taking the toll of many innocent lives. Should we continue to fight, not only will it result in an ultimate collapse and obliteration of the Japanese nation, but also it would lead to the total extinction of human civilization. This is the reason why we have ordered the acceptance of the provisions of the Joint Declaration of the Powers. The thought of those officers and men, as well as others who have fallen in the field of battle, those who died at their post of duty, or those who met with untimely death, and all their bereaved families, pain our hearts right and day. The welfare of the wounded and the war sufferers, and those who have lost their homes and livelihood, are the object of our profound solicitude. The hardship and suffering to which our nation is to be subject to hereafter will be certainly great. We are keenly aware of the inmost feeling of all of you, our subject. However, it is according to the dictate of the time and fate that we have resolved to pave the way for the grand peace for all the generations to come by, enduring the unendurable and suffering what is unsufferable. Having been able to safeguard and maintain the structure of the imperial state, we are always with you. Our good and loyal subjects rely upon your sincerity and integrity. Let the entire nation continue as one family from generation to generation, ever firm in its faith in the imperishability of its sacred land, and mindful of its heavy burden of responsibility and of the long road before it. Unite your total strength to be devoted to construction for the future. Cultivate the way of rectitude, foster nobility of spirit, and work with resolution, so that you may enhance the innate glory of the imperial state and keep pace with the progress of the world.
Iggy was appalled by the derelict state of the city. The Americans had bombed Tokyo for 3 years. 100,000 people were killed, and 16 square miles of the city were destroyed. Few concrete buildings had survived, among them the Imperial Palace. And they had been requisitioned by the occupation authorities. Amongst these was also the Imperial Hotel, which had been built in the 1920s by Lloyd Wright, who had created a series of pools around the main buildings, thanks to which the hotel had escaped, almost undamaged, the great fire that followed the 1923 earthquake, and, again, the walls of fire caused by the US bombings.
Lloyd Wright was one of the first architects to break away from the eclecticism of the 19th century. He became famous for buildings that harmonize both with their inhabitants and their natural environment. Ruby House, designed in 1908 and the first of his prairie houses, established his reputation. It demonstrated the American architect's sensitive use of materials and dynamic use of space. His other masterpieces include Falling Water, a country retreat perched over a waterfall in Pennsylvania, the Johnson Wax Building in Wisconsin, and, of course, the iconic Guggenheim Museum in New York. Wright admired Japanese art and owned a great collection of Japanese prints. He had also studied how Japanese architecture modulated space and imbued its buildings with a spiritual character. In 1893, Wright had visited the Hodon Temple, exhibited in the Chicago World Fair, and had appreciated the building's overhanging roof, geometrically shaped rooms, and sliding doors, which allowed one room to flow into another in order to create a unified aesthetic experience. At the turn of the century, Japan began embracing Western culture and technology as it looked to assert itself as a modern nation. In 1915, Japanese authorities and investors commissioned Wright to build a new Tokyo hotel where visitors could be entertained and housed in a Western style. The hotel was intended to symbolize both a cultural exchange and Japan's new status. By 1916, Wright had moved permanently to Japan, and for the next 5 years, Tokyo was to be his home. During this time, Wright oversaw the construction and design of the Imperial Hotel, which became a landmark building on the Tokyo cityscape. The hotel was a low-rise building constructed around a grand entrance with a reflecting pool, and incorporated several seismic and non-seismic technical innovations. Its outer walls were spread thick and heavy at the base, growing lighter towards the top to enhance its stability in the event of an earthquake. Wright's commitment to creating buildings suited to their environment made the Imperial Hotel an early example of synthesis between Eastern and Western sensibilities. The Imperial Hotel was amongst the few survivors of the Great Kanto earthquake of 1923, which registered 7.9 on the Moment magnitude scale, and which claimed 140,000 lives. The architect received international credit for the structural performance of his building, but it had also sustained substantial damage. It is somewhat ironic that although the Imperial Hotel also survived the fires that raged through the beleaguered city in the aftermath of the earthquake, as well as the strategic urban bombing of the Japanese capital by the United States Army Air Forces in World War II, it finally fell victim to progress. Its location at the heart of Tokyo made it very attractive for real estate development. The Imperial Hotel was dismantled in 1968 to make way for a denser and more economically viable use of land.
The American Embassy stood in the Moronouchi district. This district was described by the journalist James Morris, later Jan Morris, as follows. Moronouchi is a small American island surrounded by a Japanese sea of ashes, rubble, and rusted cans. Here Here too, in the grandest of the buildings, was General MacArthur's headquarters, Supreme Command Allied Powers, SCAP. Tokyo was a strange, defeated city where poverty was extreme, and the destruction of 60% of the city meant overcrowding in ramshackle houses. There was not enough fuel. Everyone was cold. Above all, there simply was not enough food. Japanese shed their kimonos one by one to sell for food. American goods, Spam, Ritz biscuits, Lucky Strikes, were sold on the black market by the Pampang girls, the squalid tribe of harpies who go with soldiers for food. Unorthodox activities in the aftermath of war had upset Japanese morals, such that the Pampang girls were seen as a sacrificial way of preserving the honor of the majority of Japanese women. Young Japanese aspired to wearing aloha shirts, nylon belts, and rubber-soled shoes, and the hit song Tokyo Boogie Woogie blared out from loudspeakers and nightclubs. Dewal writes that it was all vulgar, brash, hedonistic, limitless. Crippled war veterans begged on the streets. War orphans roamed around begging and stealing. Foreigners were expected not to fraternize with the locals. Iggy did not know what to expect. On his way to Japan, he had bought a book by the ethnographer Ruth Benedict entitled The Chrysanthemum and the Sword, Patterns of Japanese Culture. He seems to have read it, in fact, studied it carefully, for Dewal finds most chapters are penciled in with remarks and exclamation marks. Iggy arrived in this chaotic unknown city with his attaché case filled with small ivory monks, craftsmen and beggars. He first lived in a hotel, but was relieved when he finally moved into a house on Senchoku Lake. He was 42 and had lived in Vienna, Frankfurt, Paris, New York and Hollywood, in army billets across France and Germany, and even in Leopoldville. But he never had been able to shut a door in his own house until this first liberated, exhilarating spring in Japan. Iggy was to fall in love with Japan and never look back. He moved into this home on Senchoku Lake in the southeastern part of the city in the winter. He had been told that cherry trees grew around the lake, but he was unprepared for the spectacle offered by the cherry trees as the spring drew close. Again, Dewal regales us with a poetic statement. The drama built over the weeks in front of him until there was such an abundance of blossom that he said it was like a blinding white cloud across your retina. You lost foreground or background or distance and floated. This brings me to imagine those flat Japanese prints, void of depth, but having such a sense of airiness to them. Those prints that so inspired Charles Ephrussi's friends of the Impressionist Brotherhood back in the golden days of the Ephrussi in Paris. Iggy's home is a house made for parties. He has a healthy social life. Japanese, American and European friends frequent this house. A house with panache and none of the clutter of his childhood in the Vienna Palais. It is a dramatic interior of golden screens and scrolls, paintings and Japanese pots, created as a new home for the 264 netsuke, which are now placed in a new vitrine on three long shelves with hidden lights so that the vitrine glows at night. Here, among kindred objects, the netsuke become Japanese again. Yet many of Iggy's Japanese friends had never seen netsuke before, let alone handled them. The little trinkets had disappeared from everyday life when kimonos for men had been discouraged. Hence, men no longer had any use for the obi belt with the netsuke hanging on a cord. Here in this chapter, towards the end of the book, I understand why the author has chosen The Hare with Amber Eyes as the title for his book. In his uncle's living room, in front of the brightly lit up vitrine, the Japanese friends handled the little netsuke, as Edmond de Goncourt, Degas and Renoir had done in Charles Effoussi's salon back in the Belle Epoque days. These Japanese friends explain the meaning of each one of the statuettes. It is 1951, the year of the hare in the zodiac. This particular netsuke is made from the clearest ivory in the whole collection. It gleams because it is a lunar hare racing across the waves, illuminated by moonlight. For Iggy's Japanese guests, netsuke are part of a lost world. They are a memory of past conversations shared with long-gone grandparents. They are part of a lost world. They compare dramatically with their bleak present post-war world. Yet, they form part of the new vogue for Japanism, as can be seen in Architectural Digest issues of the 1950s, where Japanese style can be seen in a Buddha, a screen, a rough country jar reflected in a wall of mirrors, or against a wall lined in raw silk. In time, Iggy moved to another home large enough to create a separate apartment for his young friend Jiro Sugiyama, who he met in 1952. They were to be together for 41 years. Together they would explore Japan, go to exhibition of Japanese art, and to the first traveling exhibitions of the Impressionism from European museums, many of which exhibited pieces from collections that had belonged to Effoussi, Rothschild and other family friends and neighbors. But music was closest to the heart of their life together. So here, the netsuke find their fourth home, their resting place, home at last. De Waal composes yet another of his watershed sentences in this fascinating book. He describes the new vitrine in Iggy's home. It's a vitrine in a sitting room in post-war Tokyo, looking out across a bed of clipped camellias where the netsuke are washed late at night by waves of Gounod's Faust played loud. It is the home of an adopted American with his roots in Imperial Austria. So alongside the netsuke and the Japanese prince, there still are a few items retrieved by Elizabeth from their childhood home in Vienna. A few paintings depicting Austrian landscapes, finding their place in this Japanese home so far from home. It is, however, a happy home. Iggy is happy. He makes a life for himself in Tokyo, whilst once more, as in the 19th century, there is a run for Japanese art objects. GIs buy anything from kimonos to bonsai, and of course, netsuke. Time magazine writes about yen for art. The New York Times reports a sailor goes on a shopping spree. The Japanese travel bureau guide says, "The Japanese are by nature clever with their fingers. They lack an aptitude for producing anything on a large scale, or deep or substantial. But they display their nature in finishing their work with delicate skill and scrupulous execution." We are in the early 50s and Japan rises fast from the ashes of the war depression. Huge choirs sing Beethoven's Ode to Joy as part of the New Year celebrations. European orchestras visit Japan and there are regional orchestras around the country. School children take violin lessons. Iggy and Jiro go to one concert after the other. Rossini, Wagner, Brahms. As I have said earlier in the series, mankind adapts to change and life goes on. Next week, we shall be reaching the last and conclusive episode in this series entitled A Book, A Thousand Stories, with the closure of Edmond de Waal's book, The Hare with Amber Eyes. I hope you will not miss the last episode. My sincere thanks to Akiko Miyahara and to Sandra Dingley.